Emperor Tales of the Frozen South by CWB and read by Ghost of Nuggets Past. Chapter 2, Te Kororo, The Legend. Are you willing? Are you ready? Are you mine? The next night, the colony assembles again to hear Velo recount the legend of Korora and the Heartstone. Sherlock is ready to be bored because, at this point in his Arctic experience, that's what life is. Boring. He's soon captivated, though, by Vela's countenance and storytelling, and later that night, snug between his parents, he dreams of the legend and its implications. Korora, Vela explains, was the mother of flight, goddess of all winged creatures, daughter of Atutahi of the constellation Carina, and Kapua, mother of the skies. She was the protector of all penguins everywhere. At one time she walked among them, but now, Vela says, sorrow heavy on her tongue, she dwells only in the stars above them. Loving and kind, Korora ensured her progeny by selecting an unbound adult as a mate every winter. In her offspring, Korora instilled Maori, the life essence. She would descend from the skies and live among them, invisible, so that she could observe. Korora was unbiased and fair in her selection of mate, choosing with her heart an individual who was that rare combination of loving, generous, honest, and kind. She did not concern herself with outward appearances, bloodlines, or status. There were no contests, no battles, no eliminations. When her heart found its match, she would call to it in song, and her chosen, the only one to hear it, would respond in kind. Korora would transform herself before her intended and ask three simple questions. Are you willing? Are you ready? Are you mine? One word sufficed for all three questions. Aye. After hearing that response, Korora would ceremonially present her match to the colony, bless them and their hatchlings, and return to the sky with her mate. The courtship lasted through the course of one full moon, after which they returned to the colony for the passing of the egg. 64 days later, the heir would hatch. This is the way it had been for all the ages. Proof of her existence, protection, and love was personified in her heirs, who boasted a small red mark on their otherwise unblemished chests. These sons and daughters were named in accordance with Korora's wishes, but otherwise lived among their peers as equals, no more highly revered than any other individual. Their presence served to remind them all to love and be kind, to give freely of themselves, and to value each other. Each and every one was named Omarire, peaceful, harmonious. In this way, each heir became synonymous with the last, a single thread in the collective fabric of their tale. The stories passed down from creche to creche were never about a particular individual saying or doing something extraordinary, but about achieving greatness through harmony. Lessons of sharing, generosity, kindness, and respect spoke to ensuing peace for the whole. Amarire inspired courage, bravery, and determination. It overcame jealousy, spite, and insecurity. Amarire was accessible and commonplace, easy to touch and see and hold. It was an integral part of their lives. This was their way until the reckoning. No one knows any longer in which colony it happened, on what part of the continent, or during which age, but all are sure that it did happen, and that they still collectively bear the consequences. It happened like this. Korora came, and she selected a female to accompany her to the heavens. Pono, a small, quiet bird with a crippled wing, was surprised when she heard the goddess's song, but she answered the three questions with one sincere aye. matched Corora's deep and respectful courtship bow and pledged her life to care for and protect the hatchling they would create together. Sometime during the blessing of the colony, Apo, an elder of the council, came forward and interrupted, questioning why Corora had not selected a male, as had always been her way. Corora was patient and reminded Apo that whereas he was 18 winters old, which was indeed a long life for his kind, she was as old as the stars and had selected male and female mates for longer than he could possibly imagine. That he had not witnessed this himself did not make it untrue. "That may be," Apo persisted, "but how will you and Pono create an egg without the male gift?" Sherlock paused in his listening to the legend, unsure of what this male gift was or why it was necessary for the creation of an egg, but let the thought slip away for another time. Corora stood flush against Pono's side and gently reminded the elder that he could not hope to know all the mysteries of the heavens and the gods that ruled them. Her own father, Atutahi, she reminded them, had lain with the male god Terra to create her brother Ika, father of oceans, and then with the female god Kapua, a union that had produced herself. It was not theirs to question. The hatchling would be Amarire. Apo did not desist, choosing instead to push forward other candidates he found more deserving, those who were taller, broader, stronger, those with stunning markings and tremendous wingspans, all male. Each one made Pono look small, weak, insignificant in comparison. "Pono cannot even ascend to the heavens with you," he exclaimed. "Have you not seen her deformity?" Corora praised each of the presented males in turn for their strengths, but defended Pono for her kindness and grace. Pono, Corora pointed out, had helped feed the elderly members of the colony before they were greeted and carried beyond by death. She had cared for chicks who had lost a parent, shared her food, helped incubate abandoned eggs. She had given selflessly of herself, putting herself last in order to serve others. Pono's spirit, concluded Corora, was one of the most beautiful she had seen in countless cycles of darkness to light. Pono was her choice, and that choice was final. Apo stood down, unappeased, and the couple took flight, swooping and gliding in a dance of joyful pursuit until they were no longer visible. With Corora at her side, Pono flew. Many of Sherlock's peers have lost interest at this point in Vela's telling of the story, tired and distracted by the stars, the wind, the shuffling around them. Sherlock looks around, annoyed by the lack of attention being paid. Several dozen steps away, under the overhang of a small ice cave, is another chick straining to listen, bristling his down and leaning forward on his toes to catch the sound of Vela's words. He is glaring with impatience at the restless chicks around him, and there is an expression of fierce focus on his brow. Interesting. The winds pick up the storyteller's voice and carry it closer, and both Sherlock and the other emperor turn their full attention to her story. As promised, Corora and Pono return one lunar cycle later, so that Pono could stand the incubation with her peers. Corora stayed to fuss over, feed, and groom her mate. She would not go with the other females to hunt for their chicks' nourishment, as one of her gifts to her mate was the ability to feed their child from her own reserves. She was generous with her time, visiting with anyone who wished to meet with her. She conferred with the young and elderly alike, shared news from her ancestors, and informed the colony about the happenings on the rest of the continent and in the oceans beyond. Her counsel was eagerly sought on all matters of penguin life, and she gave it willingly. On the third morning, assured that Pono was settled and her work with the colony satisfied, Corora took her leave. Pono would not see her again, but this was the sacrifice she and all the others before her had made for being selected by the goddess. Her memories of courtship with Korora could last several lifetimes. She would never speak of them with her peers, and she would never mate again. Pono's descendants, however, would be plentiful, and her place of honor well secured. All was fine until the seventh evening. Agitated by Korora's choice and Pono's presence, Apo lobbied privately with a wingful of his council friends, and then called for an adjunct tribunal. He presented the case that Pono would be too small and weak to protect the heir from the dangers of their world. The minority argued that their colony would guard and care for the chick as a community, as they cared for all of their offspring. Several offered to stay with Pono and the hatchling through the summer to personally oversee the safety of them both. Apo insisted that each of them had their own families to care for and important responsibilities to the council and its members. No, he said. The real danger was inside Pono herself, in her compromised anatomy. How could she stand the fast for 64 days? How would her crippled body retain enough warmth for the egg? What if she tripped, or fell ill, or lost her way at night? No. The safekeeping of this egg was far too important to the colony. He resolved to take it as his own and finish the incubation himself. There is a hush over the assembly now. Sherlock is not surprised to see that the other chick is standing as straight as he can, his eyes forward, his bill slightly parted in concentration. That Apo is not stopped remains the greatest regret of penguin civilization everywhere, Vela explains now. What happens next is their heaviest burden. Apo approached Pano and told her what the tribunal had decided, then moved to retrieve the egg from where it rested on her small feet. They scuffled, but even at his advanced age, the elder was able to overtake tiny Pono with her weak wing, and soon wrested the egg from her. The elder then stood his ground while Pono battered herself against the bodies, claws, and bills of his cohorts, who had arranged themselves in a circle around him. Crying out for help, weakened from her flight and devastated by her inability to uphold her vow to protect the sacred egg, Pono collapsed on the ice. Korora, hearing the call of distress, raced from the stars but arrived too late. Pono was gone, her last heartbeat fading into the thrashing of Korora's wings. Distraught, enraged, Korora flung Apo aside and tucked the egg safely against her own legs, then gathered Pono's beautiful still body to her chest. While the stunned community watched, she plucked Pono's perfect heart from her breast and laid it atop Apo's feet, where it quickly turned to ice. "Forever carry this relic of my love," she told Apo, "and may the burden of finding another Amarire be yours." Korora took Pono's lifeless body and their unhatched heir back to the skies. Apo took the heartstone as if to obey Korora, but soon after threw it far into the icy tundra, never to be seen again. He himself disappeared before the vernal solstice. To this day, Vela says, Korora stays in the sky with their egg, Pono's corpse for a cape, waiting for her heir to hatch. Penguins have not flown since. Notes, Maori translations for this chapter. Korora, penguin. Atutahi, second brightest star in the sky of the constellation Carina. Kapua, cloud, bank of clouds. Maori, life essence, vital energy. Pono, true, honest, genuine. Ai, yes. Amarire, peacefulness, harmonious. Apo, greedy, grasping, covetous. Fa'aura, rescue. Fakafataikia kautu, thank you.